this morning we talked about evidences for pointing to God. That there is an existence. It had to come from somewhere. There is design. And so now I want to examine two arguments used to show. Okay, I want to look at two arguments that people often look to and say, well, no, we don't need to believe in God because of this. So we're going to examine those two arguments, and we'll hit the core point. I eliminated a bunch of technical stuff from, and we'll just hit some core points. This is the first one. We're going to be talking about Darwin's Origin of the Species. And I want you to think about the title of that. It's Origin of the Species. Keep that in mind, okay? It's been a very, very influential book. It's what started the kind of revolution. There's been a lot of research and arguments made since, but I want to look at the argument that he was making. And I want you to notice how the difference between it and what we read here in Genesis, and you'll see what I'm talking about as we go on. In the beginning, God created the heavens and earth. God said, let the earth sprout vegetation according to its kind. Let the earth keep creatures according to their kinds. That's what the Bible says. Okay, but according to the general voice of scientific community, schools, media, etc., we're told, no, that's a myth. It's refuted by Darwin and the theory of evolution. So we're going to talk about Darwin, origin, species problem, micro versus macro evolution, etc. So Charles Darwin was sent to college. His father wanted him to be a pastor, actually. And so he went there, but he was really interested in nature. He spent a lot of time doing sporting things. He liked shooting, he liked looking at bugs, he liked looking at plants, and he just did a lot of natural observation out in the wild. While he was a student, he would go on walks with one of the professors, and he would just, you know, he'd get real excited about finding some new kind of beetle. He was a very observant to the natural world, and he understood a lot of it. We're going to see some areas in which I think he's right, and we're going to see his fundamental error in his argument. I want to show you both of those. But he ended up being able to travel on the Beagle, and he serves as a naturalist on that. And there's a book, The Voyage of the Beagle. It was a British ship that sailed around the world, and young Charles Darwin goes. By the way, born on the same day as Abraham Lincoln, same year, same month. He gets on a ship. He gets on the Beagle, goes around, he collects specimens. He finds fossils that are similar to animals now, like an anteater fossil, but it's bigger. And he's thinking about that. He sees different wildlife, especially at the Galapagos Islands, and of course the very famous finches. All right, and he will observe that different finches were on those islands, and they had different niches in the environment there of how they ate. Like, for instance, if you're going to be one of these finches, if there's a nut to crack, which finch would you want to be? That dude there, I think he could get that nut pretty good. Now, if there's a little bug in a hole in a tree, which finch would you want to be? Yeah, like these guys are going to be able to get that better. And so they seem to fit different niches and everything. But Darwin looks at these, and they're out there on these Galapagos Islands, and he's thinking all these finches came from what? Some ancestral grandpa and grandma finch, right? Now, just stop and think for a moment. Think back in high school. Did some guys have a build that seemed fitting for linebacker? Did some guys have a build that seemed fitting for running hurdles? Would the guy built to run hurdles probably make it real well as a linebacker? That's why he's not linebacker, he's running hurdles. And the guy, you know, 400-pound guy playing linebacker, would he probably have done real good at hurdles? Probably wouldn't have been the fastest. So we can find our niches. But he's working on his journal, and he says he'd been greatly struck from previous marks for South American fossil species on Galapagos. These facts, especially the latter at the Galapagos, origin all of my views. Before that, he said, the view that most naturalists until recently entertained, and which I entertained, was that each species had been independently created. So in other words, here's a species, they were all independent, immutable, this has always been a species. And he thinks, no, I'm fully convinced they're not. could have been related. These could have been related. These could have been related. Things like the finches made it in. So he confronted the book and noticed the name of it. The origin of the species. Or preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. Now, let's understand what the species is, how scientists use it. It's used different way by different scientists. And you're going to see it's a fluid thing. Let's illustrate here. What is that? Somebody tell me what that is.
Rattlesnake.
Rattlesnake. Does everybody agree it's a rattlesnake? Yeah. Okay. Now, the genus is Chromalis, and the species is Origanus. Now, just in California alone, here's some different species of rattlesnake. Chromalis atrox, Chromalis mitchelli, Chromalis rubra, Chromalis Origanus. Those are a bunch of different species of rattlesnakes, but we would all agree they're what? As believers that God created rattlesnakes, do you think God had to create each of those independently? No, I think a rattlesnake would kind of do the job, right? All right. So I want you to notice this about species. Keep that in mind. Now, here's his argument. In both of these two lessons here, I want you to understand the argument, and then we're going to examine it. Here's his argument. And it's clever. I mean, it's got some merit in it. It's interesting. Variation under domestication. Variation under nature, struggle for existence, natural selection. Variation under domestication goes like this. Have we gotten a lot of variety in dogs by breeding them? Sheep, pigs, sure. And so look just in England at the different type of pigs you can get by breeding them, if that's what you want, okay? Libby has old, you know, regular chickens. And they fly around. You know, they're not the big-breasted chickens we want to fry up. But if you want to breed chickens for cooking, you know, they end up having a lot of meat on them, but they don't fly as well, okay? So you can breed and you can get variation under domestication. Second chapter, variation under nature. You look out at nature, is every one of them just the same? You start having variation in nature, right? Then struggle for existence. Not everybody's going to make it. What if every fly born this year survived and all of its eggs survived, and all of theirs? Oh, be careful. What if every elephant ever born, you know, survived? What if every animal of anything, woodchucks, skunks, whatever, if they all survived, this world would be pretty full of too many critters. So there's a brutal struggle for existence, and there's drought, there's predators, and if you don't make it, you know, you're toast, okay? So who's going to survive? Natural selection. Nature selects which to survive? The idea is the fittest. Survival of the fittest or natural selection. So in that nest, if not everybody makes it, I'm saying maybe not him. Okay, so if he doesn't make it, his genes don't get passed on. And so I get the idea. Here's variation in nature, and the ones at the lower end of the gene pool get or something. They don't live long enough to reproduce, so what does reproduce? The ones that are stronger. The idea is it keeps kind of working up. Nature keeps kind of from the underneath, and it pushes it up, and so you get this idea. Here's its flaw. I can see no limit to the amount of change. Would everybody in here agree that those finches could have come from ancestral finches?
Sure.
All right. But they were still what?
Finches.
Finches. Here's his flaw. I can see no amount of it. Slow through the process of selection may be a feeble man could do as much by his powers of artificial selection. I see no limit to the amount of change that could happen in a long course of time by nature's power of selection. And that's where he missed it. You see, yes, those finches easily could all be related, even if you identify them as different species or something. But evolution is saying something much more. Macroevolution is. This is the difference between macro and micro. That, yes. But to say that from one ancestor you got a palm tree and a penguin and a python and a petunia and a panther and a pepper and a pachyderm and a peanut and a porpoise and a pineapple and a person and a pony, that is something very, very different. That is something entirely different. Species, the Bible says God created them according to their kind. Species is a real specific thing. We're going to talk about dogs and coyotes and stuff for a minute. But first, let's look at this. Breeding canines. All right, you remember Sesame Street. One of these things is not like the other. All right, now, could you breed a dog like that?
Sure.
Yeah, you could do that. Could you breed a dog like that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you could do that. How long would it take to breed a dog like that? You can't. No, you can breed. You could breed a wide-legged dog, a short-legged dog, a long-legged, but you're dealing with dog DNA. You don't have reptile DNA in that guy. So no matter how many generations of breeding, you're not going to be able to breed a turtle. Chickens. I mean, you can breed chicken with really long tails. You can make them wide-legged, long-legged, short-legged, but they're still chickens that you can't breed into that or pufferfish again. Species problem. How many species are there? Anybody want to take a guess? How many species are there?
3 million.
3 million? 3 million. Think he's high or low?
Low.
All right. Back in 2003, Science Daily, right now we can only guess the correct answer for the total number of species is between 2 and 100 million. So, good job. Between 2 million and 100 million. Now you might be looking at that, what? That seems kind of broad. You know, between 2 and 100. Huh? Well, they have fine-tuned it, I want you to know. This is from 2011. Predicts 8.7 million. And that is between 2 and 100 million. Plus or minus 1.3 million. Species globally. Watch. Our results suggest that some 86% of species on Earth and 91% in the ocean still await description. For those of you that wonder, how could they not know? I mean, just go to the zoo, get out, you know, Animal Britannica or something, count them. Because they're saying most of them we don't even know about yet. Now, what does that make you think? What? They don't even know about most species? Then what is it going to be? Anybody got an idea?
Bugs.
Yeah, it's bugs. It's bugs. You're about to see that in a minute. It's not that they're thinking they're going to find...
One time I said there were sharks, and they said there's some sharks that live around underwater that we don't know about yet.
Yeah, there's going to be some other kind of sharks that we hadn't found yet, or something like that, maybe. They're not saying we're going to discover the Loch Ness Monster or Sasquatch or something, but a new dot arrangement on a beetle, a new coloration on a moth, a new type of ivy. In other words, it's slight variations on what we found already, plus an occasional new, oh, that's pretty cool, type thing. So, yeah, bugs. Tim's right. Usually when you think of animals, we think of vertebrate mammals, right? That's 1% of the species are vertebrates. This many are bugs. Okay? This many are beetles. Okay, almost a fourth of the species in the world are different kind of beetles. So if you're a beetle scientist, see, when you find a different beetle, look at that beetle. It doesn't look like that beetle. And so and that kind of thing. If you let beetle species scientists start defining people, do Chinese people look just like Irish people? Do Ethiopian people look just like Eskimos? If you let beetle people define people, they'd probably put us in different species. Canine. Look at all those dogs. What's the difference between a wolf and a coyote? By the way, what's one of the basic things of something being the same species? They can
reproduce. Offspring that can reproduce.
Yeah. Can coyotes and wolves reproduce?
Yes,
they can. By the way, but with their different species. Now, when I was in high school, if you're as old as me or older, you might remember this. The dog is Caninus familiaris. Not anymore. They've changed it. When I was in high school, that's Canis lupus, wolf, that's Canis latrans, coyote, that's Canis familiaris. Three different species. But bred dogs are bred dogs. It would have been bred from wild animals. And so in 1993, the Smithsonian and the American Association of Malologists reclassified the dog, so now the dog is Canis lupus. Thanks. The dog is Canis lupus. So if you have a dog at home, if it's Chihuahua, it's a wolf. It is Canis lupus. If you have a poodle, it's Canis lupus. If you have a Great Dane, it's Canis lupus. And if you have a husky, you can see he's pretty much Canis lupus. But coyotes also. So I'm trying to see, in other words, scientists are kind of arbitrary and they change their mind on what's a species or not. But these are all what? Canines. They're not snakes. They're not tomato plants. They're canines. All right? Coyotes hybridize with wolves and with dogs. There's coyote-wolf hybrids spread across. The red wolf in Canada is part coyote, they believe. What do you have there? Wolves or dogs?
Dogs.
It's some of both. There's a husky, there's a wolf, and there's a mix. Okay? So, if you start with the idea, everything any scientist has ever said is an independent species came from something else, that's proved evolution. Well, of course that has. But that doesn't prove what Darwin said, that there's no limit to change. Micro versus macroevolution. I'm going to skip talking about peppered moths. Except say this real quick. Everybody, I'm going to assume that you've heard about peppered moths and just say this real quickly. What changed was the ratio. Are they still peppered moths? Yeah, they're still peppered moths. Before the Industrial Revolution, if you're familiar with how it worked, in Lichen was killed and the trees got darker and more stuff. So, there was a higher ratio of the peppered moth of the white variety to the black mutant. After more pollution, the ratio changed. You understand that beforehand, you had both varieties. After you had both varieties, what really changed? The ratio, because of a predator. What happened in Germany in the 1930s and 40s? Did you have a higher ratio of Jews beforehand and a lower ratio of Jews afterwards? Yes, you did. Does that mean that they evolved? No, that meant a predator came through and eliminated some of them. The Nazi party, the Hitler and such. After they cleaned up evolution, the ratio went down. So that's changed, but there are still moths. All right. Back in the 80s, in the 70s, Stephen Jay Gould, very famous Harvard paleontologist, and Nice Eldridge and Stephen Sandler came along also saying these things. They proposed a new system called punctuated equilibrium, and then after that, there was a conference in Chicago. Roger Lewin, evolutionary writer, I've got different things he's written. He's written some interesting stuff. He's an evolutionist, not a creationist, but he's describing a conference in Chicago, and it was under the title Microevolution. The question of the Chicago conference was whether or not the mechanisms underlying microevolution can explain macroevolution. Make sure we understand what we're talking about here. For the ratio of whiter moths to black moths to change, is that microevolution or macroevolution?
Micro.
That you could have different types of finches, micro or macro?
Micro.
To have one cell turn into ancestral to all plants, fish, snakes, starfish, octopuses, tigers, wolves, cats, flowers, poison ivy, that's what?
Macroevolution.
Okay. So they're asking these scientists, these evolutionary scientists, can you look at the mechanisms that did microevolution and expand it? Which is exactly what Darwin did. He said, look at the variation, I see no limit to how much it can do. Later, these scientists are saying, can you do that? Can you take this and expand it? This is their answer. At the risk of doing violence position, some people in the meeting can give it as no. Read it with me. Species do indeed have a capacity to undergo minor modifications in their physical and other characteristics, but this is
limited.
That's not creationist. That's these evolutionary scientists saying, you can't just look at that and expand it to there because it is limited. That's why, if you're going to be a dog breeder, you could aim to have a spotted dachshund-shaped dog. You know, I guess get some small great Dalmatians and some big dachshunds, and sooner or later, try to get that. But you're never going to be able to breed them to be tomatoes or cucumbers or octopuses. Because it's limited. If you're working with dog DNA, you got dog DNA. Here's what they said specifically. Perlis said macroevolution should be decoupled from microevolution. Stephen Jay Gould, macroevolution is not simply microevolution extrapolated. Stephen Stanley, macroevolution is decoupled from microevolution. So, natural selection, peppered moss, different finches, wingless beetles, I don't know if we'll have time to talk about them, probably not. Yes, you can have things like that, but from a single cell to palm trees, penguins, pythons, pineapples, petunias, porpoises, peppers, and people, no. Plus, survival of the fittest does not account for the arrival of the fittest, nor does it explain how life came about in the first place. Got a friend, he's a professor at a major university. He's high up in the biology department, veterinary department, and he said if they could explain how you get from non-life to life, he said the rest, you know, is nothing compared to that jump there. If they could prove that, I could swallow some of the stuff, but that's the big jump. I mean, what we've been talking about here, huge jumps they can't do, but bigger than that is going from chemicals to life. Post-Darwin, after Darwin, they didn't understand genetics as well. In Darwin's time, Mendel's work hadn't come along, and of course people have been researching things since. But as they began to understand mutations, that began to be used as the vehicle for change. In other words, here's whatever you are, your beetles, your rabbits, whatever you are, to get more change, because, you know, for this evolution to be happening expansively, you need more variation. Well, what can be a vehicle for variation? Mutation. So mutant, mutant, mutant. Here's the problem with that. You're having to build advancement on mutations. Now that's how it works in X-Men, but in real life, you know, I have a mutation. I'm partially colorblind. So is Jeff. And so to that extent, we're mutants. And when I'm glad my mother or dad didn't say, mutation, kill it. People are going to be born with mutations. But neither, if you go into the doctor and they do some testing, they say, your baby is going to be mutated. People don't go, you know, he's going to have superpowers. No, that's not what that means. In this, the problem with mutations is, mutations tend to mess things up, not make things better. Let's use a real quick illustration. Do you remember Atari, for those of you old enough? All right, simple little computer game. Boop, boop, two colors, boop, you know, no 3D, boop, boop. Now imagine years later, you've got a ping pong game where you're playing a championship in China and you've got characters and they're doing all this stuff and you've got behind the scenes stories and everything. Did it get from Atari to this by accidental copies in the disc? No. So it's like if you've got, hey, you got that program on Atari? Yeah, I'd like to have that. Oh, you put it in the toaster. Let me see if it still works. Hey, now it has 3D. Now it has color. Now, that's not how it works. Mutations damage things. Occasionally, you might have a situation where something is beneficial in a certain spot. For instance, beetles that have lost their wings on a windy island in the ocean, where if you've got real good wings, what are you probably going to be doing? But if it's a small island and it's windy, island! So the ones that fly more got, the ones that flew less didn't. After a while, they don't have wings. Okay, on that particular place, it might be an advantage, but is that gaining organs, gaining information, or is it a loss? It's kind of like if I've been in an accident and I've lost my legs. That's not generally an advantage. But if we're walking down the street and a guy comes by with a machine gun and mows us down at chest height, at that particular time, it ended up being an advantage. But that doesn't mean, look, a new organ. I've still got a what? It's a loss, okay? You might find a situation where it can be helpful, like sickle cell anemia. But it's that, all right, we need to stop there, And, we're going to stop there, except for this one little chart I want to show you here. I found this some years ago. Eugenie Scott, if you've ever seen Expelled, she's one of the ones quoted in there. She was involved in the Dover trial a few years ago. One time I was at the library and I was reading in a science journal, and this is what she said. Avoid debates. If your local campus Christian fellowship asks you to defend evolution, please decline. Public debates rarely change many minds, and you will probably get beaten. Some other scientists wrote in and argued with her on that. She responded back a few months later. They take issue with my petition against formal debates with creationists. I find the duty to defend science argument pales next to that of above all else do no harm. The vast, vast majority of formal debates decrease public support for evolution, which discourages teachers from teaching. I suggest we put our egos aside and above all else do no harm. How many times have you heard them say, oh, it's a fact just like the fact that the world is round, or just like the theory of electricity? Really? I don't think you would ever hear her say, avoid debates. If somebody asks you to defend the orbit of the Earth, please decline. You'll get beaten. Avoid debates. If somebody asks you to defend electricity, please decline. You'll probably get beaten. I don't think you can win. I think you plug something in. Electricity. I'm done. So, let's stop there. Two different belief systems. We didn't see what happened, so our job is to look what? At the evidence that remains. In Romans 1:20, we see evidence of desire. Thank you. Let's sing those two verses.